Hello and welcome to yet another episode of the Mission Chunya podcast. First, thank you for spreading the word about Mission Chunya around. The engagements across social media, podcast, and even emails are on the rise. It feels good when you have people who get back to you from around the world. So keep it coming. In the last few years, we have come across multiple commitments from a range of global corporations, committing from going from 100% RE or reducing their carbon emissions or even turning net positive. So what are these targets based on? How realistic are these targets from timeline perspective? We will discuss this and more on this episode. This episode is a candid chat with our guest who has done a lot of work in the sustainability space, particularly being an active campaigner for the European Union's new Green Deal. He also leads the sustainability initiatives for a large chemical company. So my guest for this episode is...
Hi, I'm Thaddeus Anumsamua. I'm Engineering Manager Projects at Croda. Croda is a chemical company which provides specialty chemicals, which are ingredients, we call them building blocks for all your everyday products. So we're talking about everything from seeds to toothpaste to cars even. So, and why my job there is really about innovation, long-term innovation, and I've been working a lot on sustainability roadmaps and plans for the future.
First, a big congratulations. You got featured as one among the 30 under 30 in the Forbes list for Europe this year.
Yeah, thanks. That's a lot due to some of the sustainability stuff that I've been trying to do.
And yes, we are just going to have a candid conversation about sustainability, the circular economy, and these are the topics of interest to you, and you have done some work in this space. So let's just get started. I mean, where do you see, or how do you see this emergence of circular economy, especially in the sustainability transformation?
Yeah, I think when we're talking about sustainability, there's often talked about climate change, which is very important. We've seen some of the effects of climate change. Of course, we're talking about then extreme weather, droughts, floods, forest fires. But then there's other aspects to sustainability, and sustainability is about, you know, making a future for all of mankind. And one of that is circular economy. And circular economy is key to climate change because it means that you're going to, you know, reuse products and reduce the kind of demands that you're putting on the earth in terms of the products that you're putting there. But also it's key to something else, which is the toxicity, which is what do we do with the products once we've used it, you know? And that's something that you're seeing right now with kind of plastic cleanup initiatives. That's because, you know, that plastic waste and the household waste, and a lot of that's going to landfill. A lot of that is going into the rivers and ending up in the sea, ending up on shores. You know, that's causing pollution. And I think this is a really big issue that we need to tackle, because at the end of the day, if the fish eat the plastic, it's not just bad for the fish. It's bad for us because we eat the fish, you know. So it's a whole cycle and interconnectedness of the world.
That is exactly right, because the way is generally seen is there are two ends to it. One, as you said, it could also lead to reduced dependency on virgin resources. And on the other end, the chemicals that get into the environment, the toxicity of that is really crucial, and we need to stop that. And that is why circular economy is kind of very crucial. Now, how do you think this has evolved in the industrial sectors? You work in the industrial sector, and how do you see the emergence of this concept, or rather the adoption of this concept in industrial clusters in Europe?
In Europe in particular, I see that the European Green Deal, which is being done by the European Union, is addressing circular economy in particular. And if you even on an international scale, you know, the UN SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals, do also talk about responsible consumption and production. So we are talking about circular economy. You know, a lot of national governments also having circular economy initiatives. And the reason that it's really emerging right now is because the way that we use products is just unsustainable, you know, and you've got to think this with circular economy. Of course, you can recycle a product by just recycling it, chemical constituents, and, you know, making another plastic bottle from the plastic bottle, or making a new plastic toy from a plastic bottle. But you can also think about reusing it. That would be even better, or even upcycling it to something of higher value than it was previously, you know. So and when you're talking about reusing or upcycling, you are actually eliminating CO2 that would be consumed in the manufacture and the transport and everything of the virgin products, you know, and that is, so in any case, you're always reducing the amount of virgin product coming from the ground when you're talking about circular economy. But in other cases, you can be also reducing massive amounts of CO2 as well. And more importantly, you can be, you know, reducing massive amounts of toxicity for animals, for fish, for plants, and for humans.
Is there any way in which the hazardous substances are classified, or how has it evolved? I mean, we talk about toxicity, but are there any steps, or are there any regulations under which chemicals are classified under different hazardous levels?
Yeah.
Because industries have to adapt and stick to some protocol, right?
Yeah, there are, of course, worldwide, it's dependent on the country, but there are hazardous substance regulations, absolutely. Actually, the hazardous substance regulations are, one, protecting the environment from hazardous pollution, but two, also to protect industry from incidents with these hazardous substance incidents, maybe to the employees or to the neighborhoods around these. And, you know, in principle, if everybody's following the regulations, nothing bad happens. But of course, we know that accidents happen, and sometimes it's not even accidents that happen. People know what's going on, and they choose to continue with their pollutions. And there's a movie called Dark Waters, which is a fantastic movie with Mark Ruffalo. It's about a true story of DuPont, you know, in their neighborhood of a factory in the U.S. Cows started dying. You know, there was no toxicity regulation. There was nothing clear cut that was coming from DuPont. But coincidentally, now, wildlife was dying, animals were dying, and DuPont knew about it, but they were not doing anything further to investigate whether they were really the cause. And in the end, they were the cause. And that's why it's called Dark Waters. And DuPont, this is one case, but of course, there's been many cases of this. And what happens then sometimes, unfortunately, is not that we make production safer, or that we even stop the use of these hazardous substances. Sometimes we just simply go make it somewhere else with less regulation, which is the wrong way to go. If you're looking at, for instance, viscose rayon, which is one of the clothing substances which is very popular today. It's a synthetic fiber, even portrayed to be a green because, you know, it uses less water than some other substances, right? But the production of it is toxic. It's actually so toxic that people in US and EU found this out years ago, and toxic to humans I'm talking about, and they banned it. There are now no production facilities because they can't meet up to the health and safety regulations in the US. Yet we are still having, of course, lots of viscose and rayon clothing coming from, you know, China, so, and India and other countries. So we've now decided that it's okay in some way for us to get our money as long as the toxicity is somewhere else, you know. And at the end of the day, that is still, you know, killing people, that's still polluting people. So we need to think about it. And yeah, it's not just governments that need to think about it, but it's also the consumer at the end of the day, because the consumer buys the product.
That's a good point, that consumers have to be aware of where the product comes from, what is the toxicity level of that. But without government actually having a set of regulations in place to keep track of what the industries are doing in the industrial clusters, how can consumers be more aware of it? I mean, unless the companies themselves, for example, if DuPont had to say, this is the production cycle that we use, this is the toxicity level of each of the production industries, factories that we have. Unless the companies, or rather the governments, enforce regulations, how else can consumers get awareness around the products they buy?
And this is actually something that the EU was looking to address in the Green Deal, and in the future, actually, with some kind of product labeling, you know, because at the end of the day, regulations are normally there to make production safe, but it's up to the consumer to choose whether they want the sustainable product, which might be more expensive, or they want the other product, which they've been used to buying for all these years. And in order to make that choice, they need actual information. It's confusing right now which product is actually sustainable and better for the earth. And even the products that you think are sustainable, at least they, you know, they're promoting themselves as sustainable. Sometimes they're not, because of something that we call greenwashing, where companies are being very selective about which eco label they choose or which facts that they choose in order to say something is very green, when on another criteria it would be actually not sustainable. So the EU is looking at ways of bringing that information to the customer so that they can make an informed decision, looking at ways of regulating this. But at the end of the day, if the customer gets the information, they also have to care enough to choose the alternative. And if they really want the information, you know, they can also put pressure on governments to put in regulation to make this information available.
That is correct. Unless consumers actually raise their voice, it's actually tough for the governments to put in the regulations on the industries. But we have spoken about industries, we've covered a different set of companies also. But I'm sure there are some outliers. In this case, companies who are doing a really good job proactively in this space by addressing the concerns and being sustainable in the true sense. Would you cite some examples?
Well, I don't want to promote my own company, but we've one of several companies, of course, is companies, other companies like DSM, I've also made climate pledges, but in the chemical industry, I'm quite proud to work for Croda. And we've made pledges, you know, that we want to be climate positive. You know, we want to be land positive. We want to be people positive in 2050, you know, and we're talking about net zero emissions in 2050, of course, but we're not just talking about net zero emissions. We're talking about actually saving emissions. That's what climate positive is talking about. That's talking about providing an alternative that is going to save emissions, and that can be in the use, but that can also be from the ingredients that you choose. And right now there's the customer needs an alternative. In some cases there isn't a sustainable alternative. So that's what companies, it's a call to all companies out there, really, to just give the customer the sustainable option.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful to hear about Croda. And it also resonates with the theme of the podcast, getting to net zero, getting to net zero emissions in the long run. And it's interesting that you bring about the idea of companies pledging to get to net zero by 2050. And since Croda has also pledged to be planet positive, how does this work? And how do these pledges come about? Even large corporations like Microsoft has pledged to be positive, net positive. So how do these pledges come about? What is the thinking that goes into making these pledges?
Absolutely. Microsoft is also one of the companies that is saying it'll be net zero. And the reason behind these pledges is the consumer. Let's be honest about it. Companies want to make money. And if the consumer is willing to pay more for a sustainable product, then companies will change. And there's consumers out there that are ethically aware, sustainably conscious, and they are asking for these alternatives. And companies like Microsoft are hearing this, and they're getting ahead of the game and trying to lead the way in that. And there's different ways to be net zero. One of the ways is to compensate, of course. You can compensate by, for instance, planting trees for all the emissions you plant. But, you know, what you need to look is not just net zero. You also need to look at what are they pledging in terms of the amount of emissions that they'll decrease. So, for instance, in Croda, we said we're going to decrease our emissions by 50% in 2030, which is a pretty drastic amount, you know, compared to 2018. That's a huge amount that we're saying. So we're not just going to, you know, plant a whole load of trees. We're actually going to reduce how much we're emissions that we're making. And that is concrete reductions. And that requires innovation and a culture and collaboration. And it's not something that you can do just by saying it.
It's good that you mentioned about Croda, because if you look at Microsoft, everyone would probably relate to Microsoft and probably say Microsoft, or for example, even Google. Everyone could say like all these tech companies have huge data centers, huge power demand. Probably they need to get to 100% renewable energy as one of the ways. For a chemical company, what does this mean? I mean, what is the biggest bottleneck for you to achieve? Because the other question, a layman's question, would be like, why 2050? Why can't you do it by 2030? What is the biggest bottleneck that you see for a chemical company or someone in this sector to get to net zero?
I think at chemical companies, manufacturing companies in general, so also fast-moving consumer goods, steel, and food industry are having very similar challenges in that it's, you're not just about renewable electricity, because some of your energy is going into electricity, some of it's also going into heating. With renewable electricity, of course, there is the availability of renewable electricity. In some countries, it's just not available, so you have to be a little bit smarter about how you're going to reduce your emissions, and you can't go 100% renewable because, you know, there isn't land for solar panels, or you're not in a climate where there's a lot of sun that would be efficient, or there's not winds for wind, or you don't have, you know, the kind of currents that would make hydroelectric power efficient. So it really depends on the availability, for one. And the second is, you know, just the technology. You've got a plant, a factory. Factories last 30 years, normally at least, some of them 40, some of them, you know, even 50 years. So you've built your factory, you know, it's quite difficult to and expensive to change your factory, you know, and when you're changing your factories, if we're talking about chemicals, right, a chemical reaction has a certain amount of heat that it needs. It needs to be at a certain temperature to be effective. So that heat, you need to think about different ways of providing that heat. Eventually, you could get it from electricity. It would be very expensive, so that's why they can't do it right now, because then maybe even some companies wouldn't even be viable if they had to do it from electricity. And they would have to move manufacturing away or completely stop manufacturing altogether. So they need to rethink how they're doing the whole chemistry of it and try and do something at low temperature, you know, instead of maybe boiling off via distillation impurities, they need to start thinking of other technologies, maybe membranes and vacuums and different ways of getting that same separation. And we're talking about advances in biotech also being used. So it's really about reimagining the chemistry, the technology, the whole process that you're doing to redesign a new process, a process that is sustainable, a process that makes a product that can be recycled, you know, and that is has to be in your mind from the start.
That's a good summary of how the chemical industry could probably get to net zero, and it kind of clearly illustrates the different challenges at different levels, be it heat, be it chemical sourcing, or be it even minor details like membranes and other technological challenges that are there at every level for, say, even a factory to get to net zero. So that's a good short summary on the chemical industry. Before we get to the final point on the EU Green Deal, for which you have had an active involvement, one quick question on the industrial clusters in general. I mean, there are a lot of industrial clusters in Europe that claim to be net zero industrial clusters, probably one in Denmark. Are there any more clusters like that coming up, or do you think clusters like that are a big success story that will start to emerge?
I think what you're seeing, and it's one of the reasons that also in the SDGs collaboration, partnerships is mentioned, is that through partnership, not through competition always. Competition is good, but sometimes you need to partner with your competitors to achieve a coordinated solution together. And that's what you're seeing in some of the industrial clusters. For instance, if you want to make, you know, a green steel, you know, if you want to make green hydrogen, you need green electricity. So you need to kind of be in partnership with somewhere that can provide you that green electricity or make it yourself. And if you want to talking about the sustainable supply chain, we're talking about the ingredients in the, because it's a full life cycle analysis that we're talking about. And that means you need to partner with your suppliers. You need to partner with your customers in order to really have that success. And one of the things that we're seeing now in a lot of changes, for instance, waste heat, right? You might have flares right now getting rid of your waste heat, or you might just even be cooling down your waste heat, which is a double loss, you know, and you've never thought about integrating it with your neighbors or with the community, but that waste heat from industry, from one industrial site, might be able to be used in the next industrial site that needs heat at a different temperature, or it might even be able to be used in house heating, you know. And this is the kind of integration and collaboration that we need if we're going to really make a difference in how we're doing things. And we want to, you know, hit our targets, because it's a question of accelerating. You know, the climate is not waiting for us to get our act together.
True. Accelerating towards the targets is something we will discuss as a final point on the EU Green Deal. You have been an active advocate. You have done a lot of campaigns around this. So how is the EU Green Deal in its current form? How is it going to enable this acceleration towards net zero?
Yeah. So what we're seeing right now in the EU Green Deal is we're seeing some ambitions. And to be clear, like the EU Green Deal, it needs to be still fleshed out in terms of exactly what it means. Because as we know from the Paris Agreement, which has been there for a long time, ambition is not enough. You know, in the Paris Agreement, we already talked about 1.5 degrees, keeping global warming to 1.5 degrees. Instead, we were going to keep it to under 2 degrees, but we didn't. So the EU Green Deal, what I've been trying to work and advocate for is that it goes a step further than ambitions and talks really about regulations that enforce and ensure that we reach those ambitions. And that's something that the EU is also trying to do. They're also trying to set up some collaboration. So part of the Green Deal is something called the European Climate Pact, where they're trying to bring people together to collaborate and to act so that they can really activate ideas from all sources, industry, communities, also communities that are not necessarily pro climate action. There's a lot of communities that maybe against it, because for instance, if you close a coal mine, yeah, that's good for the environment. You're going to use wind power instead of coal, but it's sad for those people that lose their jobs who used to work in the coal mine. How are you going to address that? You know, and that's the kind of conversations that need to be had. And I am positive about the Green Deal because I see that Europe wants to be a leader. I see some good ambitions in there. I see rhetoric about a green recovery after the COVID crisis. But at this moment, it is mainly words. And we need to still do a lot of work to ensure that it becomes action, because there's a lot of different interests at stake here. And not everyone wants the same thing.
Perfect. It's good to know that Europe wants to be a leader in this, and hopefully, as you said, it's everything in words at this moment, but hopefully countries actually take action towards it, and hopefully it's a success, because post-COVID, we definitely want a green recovery, and because we don't want to see, as others foresee, that climate change being the next pandemic, so hopefully that's not the case. Thaddeus, it's been a pleasure talking to you on this podcast about zero toxicity, EU's Green Deal, and the circular economy. It's a wonderful conversation, and thanks for your time.
Thanks, Girish. I'm more than happy to talk, more than happy to collaborate and exchange ideas.
Yes, we need people like Thaddeus to join hands and collaborate on projects that gets us to net zero emissions. As always, I'm more than happy to discuss new ideas and suggestions from people I meet and get introduced to. I'm sure you are really excited with that. I continue to get topic suggestions and guest recommendations from time to time. Please do send me your ideas. missionchunia@gmail.com is the ID. And of course, Mission Chunia is across the social media channels. So feel free to tag Mission Chunia on a post. The handle is @missionchunia. So now let's get to this week's action item towards Mission Chunia. Sticking to this week's theme, just a reminder about the importance of segregating waste. Segregating waste before you dispose them off can be a crucial factor in the entire value chain. I'm sure waste segregation is practiced around the world, so it all begins at home, where you can segregate food waste from other recyclable waste, and in these times, the medical waste like masks. Local corporations have different schedules in which these waste are collected from households, so make a note of it and do your bit. Small actions like this will go a long way. As always, let's start with one step at a time. And before we sign off, make sure you're subscribed to the show, because I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with yet another episode. You can also check the playlist and listen to a previous episode if the theme aligns with your interest. And if you like the show, do give a rating, write a review, or share it with your friends and colleagues. It takes only about 30 seconds to share the episode link with 3 people in your network. So please consider doing that. So signing off, this is Girish Shivakumar, and as always, thank you for listening.